Doc, this was after he had died, after Tom had died.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, Gene Miller was still there.
Uh-huh.
At the time.
Were you tempted to buy the company? No advantages to you?
No. That was way out of my league. I didn't have any reason. I don't think anybody, I don't know probably whether Garfield was. It was mainly an indexing and abstracting operation. I hired a number of people from them who came to me, but no.
Hmm. So Lisco went on with the contracts for a while, and then I don't think they got into the information business, or got out of the information business,
no,
did they?
Didn't.
I've been trying to track down the records of the company, mm-hmm. of Doc Inc., and haven't been able to track down what's happened to them. In your 1962 article in American Documentation, the one called Methods of Organizing Information for Storage and Searching,
yeah.
you seem to express some feelings of frustration about the ability of folks in the field to, quote, take one another's word for what works and is best for retrieval, going from simple to complex systems and then back again. I gather that you were really frustrated when you said this, that we don't really have an empirical or scientific basis for what makes a good system. Am I putting words in your mouth,
no,
though?
No, at the time I didn't think they had evaluation criteria. I didn't think most people were arguing for the sake of arguing. I never we used to sit and discuss around and around and around, and again everybody was right and everybody was wrong. Where was that paper published?
American Documentation. So you felt that the field wasn't making the kind of progress that it needed to be making. For example, the kind of progress you were making on user studies,
mm-hmm.
what looked to me very good, and that folks, with that we were building a pretty good solid body of information there.
Mm-hmm.
But I gather for storage and searching, you were not at all happy with how things were mm-hmm. developing.
Either that or I didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm. What are your feelings now about the field?
Oh, now, my God, I hate like hell to read the American Documentation. Is it a journal?
Or
JASIS.
Uh-huh.
Because it's all, everybody's trying to find the magic formula for retrieval or whatever it is. You know, they want the mathema, they want the model.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I see in there. Once, in the course of a paper, it was this, one of these Miles Conrad lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And I was intrigued in one part of the paper by the fact that everybody celebrates Shannon and Weaver's communication theory, and they always focus on the communication part. But if they read the thing closely, the book, there's a big section on by Weaver on how, by what mechanisms do these messages, I mean, or what do these messages contain, and what do they do? And so, yeah, there's what about negentropy? And I still feel that these people are sort of desensitizing the meaning. They want to know how fast, how many, and they try to combine all kinds of things like relevance and recall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the purity of the message.
Mm-hmm.
Not the goodness of the message or the effectiveness of the message, but what can be quantified. And of course you can have an index to anything, and you can make your own arbitrary grades, and sometimes they do that, and that's interesting. But there has to be a method of evaluating impact,
mm-hmm.
meaning to the recipient.
The value of the system?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the recall and precision, what were your reactions when you first read about the Cranfield studies? And
as a matter of fact, I was in London with my wife, and we stopped off at ASLIB headquarters, and I heard about it. I met Will Flancaster, who was working there at the time.
Wow.
And I was very impressed. The only thing is, who determines whether this is relevant? So we used to have big arguments. Who is it relevant to? The user?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Will said, no. I mean, I go through and I say, this is relevant to the reference question, and this isn't. So I would say it's in general. And of course, what is the relationship of relevance and recall? What's he call it?
To precision.
Precision and
uh-huh.
recall.
Yeah.
And the greater the precision, the lower the recall, and vice versa. And I don't know. You can prove it is true. But I don't think it's very beneficial.
Yeah, but it's the relevance issue that has caused so much trouble trying to figure out how that operates. Huh?
Yeah. Well, everybody liked it. It's a nice package.
Yeah. Well, now, did you have something to do with Lancaster coming to the U.S.? Because you hired
him.
Oh, you did. So you offered him a job? And I noticed that he had done, you all had a number of articles together.
Yeah.
So
well,
was
when I was over in London, his wife's American. So the first thing he said to me is, if you hear of any jobs in the States, let me know. My wife is, what you say, aching to get back. To the States, and a circumstance arose where I needed somebody in a hurry who know all about indexing. And I said, would you be, I called him and said, would you be interested in a non-research indexing position? And he said, absolutely. And he was over there 2 weeks, over here 2 weeks later.
Oh, and he was on your staff full time for how long?
About 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he went over to NLM to do this study for.
Oh, the evaluation of the Midlars project.
I was furious.
Really? He abandoned you in the middle of a project?
Well, no. I got somebody else, but. What happened was that Marty Cummings wanted to do this study, and they kept sounding me out, would I be interested? But it wasn't Marty directly, it was one of his staff members. And then the next thing I hear, Marty doesn't want a profit-making organization to do it. So instead he hires Wilf away from me, and Wilf was so overwhelmed by the opportunity. I'm asking him, don't do it, Wilf. And he said, God, I can't pass up this opportunity. So he didn't. We remained friends, but see.
But you lost business right there, huh?
Oh, yeah. My plan was that he would do it working for us.
Yeah. Now, he had been on the Cranfield studies, right?
Yeah. He was with...
with Cleverdon.
Cleverdon.
Mm-hmm. Now, during this time, you've taught, I had from 64 to 68 at the University of Maryland.
No, at Drexel.
At Drexel.
Mainly Drexel.
Now, how did you manage to do that and keep your business going?
I used to go up once or twice a week at 6 o'clock. It was tough. And I used to come back on a 10 o'clock train, I remember. And I did. I enjoyed it.
So just once a week you were doing this for a class?
Yeah, it was a three-hour session.
What? How did you get involved with Drexel?
I guess I was asked by John Harvey, who was the dean at the time. And I thought, gee, this is a funny idea. Let's try it.
Yeah. And so they had just...
Good.
So this was right when Drexel had started their information science program.
Right. No, this was the library school. And I was just more or less, I was one of the first information science people they had then.
Right, that's what I mean. But they say that they started their information science program in 63, I think, with you and Claire Schultz maybe being
Claire,
the sum total of it.
Yeah, I remember. Remember Belver coming in and poo-pooing us.
Oh, really?
And he was an old friend, as a matter of fact, here. He lived in Washington. He was a client. Belleville was a client. He was in the American Psychological Association. And he was a client at the time. And then he went over there. He got on his high horse because they gave him a special professorship. And I think well deserved, but he was nasty to me.
Really?
And I guess to Claire, sarcastic.
What was he unhappy with? What course were you teaching?
I was teaching methods of mechanization. And I was using Charlie Bourne's first textbook as a text. And it was at that time, it was the bridge between the you could say punch cards or elementary machines, and the computer. That was one aspect. Different forms of communication. We talked about what they called facsimile, but it wasn't facsimile at the time. Long distance facsimile, LVX, and all the early machines. And I had about 20 different categories: communications devices, searching devices. It was a sort of hodgepodge. But it was interesting. Had a terrific class.
And so what was Griffith's son happy with?
Oh, that was after. Well, he thought it was all amateurish. And I suppose in a sense, in his time, it was.
Because you should have been teaching the general purpose computer or using the mainframe?
Well, no, he wanted me to be concentrating on studies, not this crap.
Studies?
Yeah, I remember saying, that's not your bag.
Studies of information retrieval or user studies?
User studies, any kind of studies. We subsequently tried to do a couple of studies together, but we couldn't make them go. Try to get grants from the National Science Foundation and from the National Army Medicine. Just wouldn't give them to us. Contracts, I should say. So we never, so we sort of fizzed. And he was busy. All these guys get married every 15 minutes, you know. He had a new wife.
Oh, really? How would you describe the Drexel program at that time? Was it strictly the two courses that were information science oriented, the one you taught and the one that Claire talked,
yeah, at that time, yeah.
The rest of the program was pretty traditional?
Absolutely traditional.
But Harvey wanted to take it in another direction?
I think he did, yeah. Yes, he did. He was ill-defined, but they... And then they had me teaching a course in research methods. And that sort of fizzed. We discovered that the students weren't interested in research methods. They were interested in researching them and doing a bibliography. And I was doing all kinds of operations, research exercises. And it was driving the students crazy.
Were you doing much with statistics then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, boy, that drove them up to the wall.
I teach a research methods course also. Have the same experience.
One of them wrote a letter to Harvey about me, saying this is not research. As high as we go research. And Harvey sent me a copy of the letter. And I got angry and insisted, whoever wrote that letter, get the hell out of here. And the person I suspected wrote the letter disappeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I decided, I told John, I don't think I'm comfortable with this setup. And I was teaching this other course, and it was getting kind of cluttered.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now he's going up twice a week. And I remember saying, I don't have to come up here twice a week to be insulted.
Didn't you teach a course at Maryland also?
Yeah.
When was this?
She taught one year. And it was on communication methods. Wide open, whatever I wanted to make it. And we had sessions dedicated to the science. What was the guy who wrote about the two worlds, the world of science and the world of...
C.P. Snow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We focused on that for a while. And...
Was Maryland pretty traditional also in the 60s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The dean was...
Wasserman.
Wasserman. Paul Wasserman, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't know what to make of me.
Mm.
And I don't know what to make of him. So we finally agreed to disagree.
Yeah.
Well, all these things, I was very busy at least at that time. I can't remember what I was busy about, but I found it very difficult to drive out to College Park.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were getting a lot of business during that time for the company.
Yeah.
Well, sum up for me the problems, opportunities that the independent entrepreneur in the information field has had to contend with over these years.
Well, too much dependence on the government and its idiosyncrasies, which are many, and too much temperament in my stage. In the early stages, too many prima donnas in the field who really weren't communicating. Moores didn't communicate very well with Tao, for instance, and Tao didn't communicate with anybody. He was always watching his back. And that was one of the biggest problems. Then the people in government who were running most of the shows, and that was the National Science Foundation, they were tended to be, you could sell them a bill of goods. And if they liked you, they bought it. And that was a problem at the time. Because I'm not likable.
Mm.
If they like my jokes, or they like my humor, then I'm likable. But if they don't, and a lot of them didn't.
It was more based on personality than on science?
Absolutely. Huh. Absolutely.
Why was this?
Because they had no, there were no controls. People, what I find is that people respond not to their instincts, but to what they have to do. Most people are good and honest, but given a set of strictures, rules, spend all the time evading or working within constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a lot of evasion, a lot of peculiar things go on. Mm. They meet the letter of whatever it is and not necessarily what's needed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I still find that. As a matter of fact, we seem to be reverting to that. It used to be you could put out a competitive proposal and either give it to a friend, competitive RFP, request for proposals, or you could make it truly competitive. And in many cases, it was truly competitive. And for a while there, everybody played by the rules. They would try to get advantages through intelligence, mm-hmm. by talking to people, by knowing people, by networking. And that was fair game. If somebody's that ambitious,
mm-hmm.
he ends up deserving. And he's probably going to be the most knowledgeable person writing the proposal. And I think that's pretty healthy. But then I see some crazy things happening where I don't know whether I want to get into this. We have problems with this is crazy, and I'm sure we're both going to decide to excise what I'm about to say, but I've had more damn trouble with black female project officers. And I don't know why, I'm mystified.
Hmm. Within the government.
Within the government.
Hmm.
And they play dirty. And they obviously, it's never said, but they like the idea of lording it over or having control over Caucasians. I think. And we're always in the middle. It's been an awful lot of time trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's never said, never stated. But it's always there.
Mm. And this has been a particular problem in recent years, huh?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, change. Whenever you call the Small Business Administration about anything, the first question they ask is, are you an 8A firm?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, no, I'm not an 8A firm, I'm a small business firm. For a while, my wife was the president and majority stockholder firm. We try to be a woman-owned firm.
Mm-hmm.
And that got us a little business, or very little. But that shouldn't be necessary. Because
mm-hmm.
these are all pretexts. We just transfer stock.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. You've been a stock-owned company, but you or your wife owned 100%.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm. What seems to me is that you tried to play a dual role here. You tried to advance the field, and you tried to make a living as a private entrepreneur. Am I assessing this correctly?
Yes.
And how do you, certainly you've been successful as a company, how do you feel you've been successful in trying to advance the field?
Oh, in a very tangential way. Mainly for instance with Gene Garfield and Boris Ansgar, I'm one of the founders of the Information Industry Association. And it's mainly through contacts with friends. You sit around and complain, and that's how Garfield got from ADI to ACES. And I've sort of been in and around all those things, those pivotal times, just circumstance.
Talk about the formation of IIA. How did this idea begin and grow?
Well, Garfield wanted something. It started out, Garfield and Ansgar called me. I was not an initiator. And they said, don't you think we should have the equivalent of ADI or ACES for for-profit outfits? And that's what was introduced to me.
Garfield called you with this idea. And what happened next?
And we had a meeting and decided yes. And it's strictly for-profit firms. And then Bill Knox was looking for a job. He was in McGraw-Hill. And they fired him. It's funny, I thought I was going to get a lot of business from McGraw-Hill through Bill Knox. And the next thing I know, he's running he's the first president or head of IIA.
How did IIA grow? Just the two of you were the initial two companies?
Oh, we had about eight companies. I remember, because we had a board of directors. And I was on the first board of directors. I didn't want to be an officer, I remember. And had all kinds of